Chapter 9, December 8th, Hunter's Night. When Martin heard bells, he leaped off the cot in horror, thinking that the discs had come again. It took another moment for him to become aware that sunlight was slanting in the barred window of the little cell. Despite everything, he had been asleep. The bells were being rung over at Third Street Methodist, bells that Martin had been responsible for ringing just a few nights ago. And now here he was in this hideous situation, and with no idea why this had happened to him. Somebody in the government had done this, but who? And why ever would anybody consider an archaeologist dangerous? He had thought all night about it, reviewing his published work, his experiences in the pyramid and in the White House, and he had reached the tentative conclusion that there must be something in his knowledge of the past that made him potentially dangerous. So dangerous that, even when their world was collapsing around their ears, they would still reach out for him. It wouldn't be supposition. They would know. His thought was that the lenses and the discs represented some sort of machine. He knew that a great human civilization had fallen in about 12,000 BC. It had not been a technological civilization like ours, but it had possessed profound scientific knowledge, including, and especially, a science of the soul. It had also left a very precise prediction that the present age would end on December 21st, 2012. The Maya, possessing fragmentary knowledge from this far more ancient culture, had integrated this date into their system of calendars. In fact, they had started with that date and worked backward. That's how important they believed, or knew, that it was. They had gotten the date, he felt sure, from a city that was now deep underwater off the coast of Cuba. This immense metropolis was probably the capital of what legend called Atlantis, and there was something quite strange about it. What was strange was that the British Navy had been guarding the site, and the Canadian archaeological group who had made the discovery 10 years ago had been prevented from returning. It should have been a scandal, but the profession was just as happy that the discovery was being suppressed. Its revelation would overturn 100 years of theory and wreck dozens of important careers. Martin had lobbied various institutes to open research in the area. He'd even published a letter condemning the military action and the archaeological record. He demanded explanations. They weren't trying to kill him because they thought he was to blame for the disaster. They were trying to kill him because he was one of the few people in the world who had any chance of understanding it. The bell stopped with a suddenness that seemed almost to shudder the dew that clung to the 3 yellow leaves he could see through his bars. He saw cars go past, heading for the church. They were gathering there. Then they would come for him. He felt like a rat, exactly like a rat, except that a rat only wanted to escape, and he was tormented by thoughts of his family. All night, he'd suffered over Lindy and his poor little Winnie, who had been limping, and his lost son. The things that had appeared behind the wanderers after dark, he thought that they must be a sort of cleanup crew, destroying the stragglers. That mangled boy had been their work. Was Trevor also a mangled boy? Sounds came from the office, a voice raised, then dropping. Bobby's voice sounded angry. Then he blustered in. 56 to 15, he said, not looking at Martin. Hey, Martin said. I have no idea how to hang anybody.
Use your pistol, Martin. He had to stop. He swallowed, pulled himself together. We gotta go now. We're gonna do it over by the bank. There's that tree there.
Christ, you're not serious about this.
They're getting rope.
I'm sorry. So damn sorry.
This was actually going to happen.
Bobby, I haven't done anything.
I know it. He raised his eyes. But what if you have? Oh, for God's sake! Martin, please don't make me, you know, drag you.
As Martin came out, Bobby took his cuffs off his belt.
Bobby, come on.
Martin, it's regs.
Okay. If you put the cuffs on me, I am going to need to be dragged every inch of the way, and I am going to scream, goddammit, because I have lost everything, and now even my life, Bobby, and for nothing, not a thing, zip.
Bobby put a hand on Martin's shoulder.
Come on, let's deal with this.
They would not know how to hang anybody, and so would tie the rope around his neck and drag him up where he would die in a slow fugue of suffocation. Bobby had been a friend not to cuff him, and he noticed also that he wasn't exactly holding on to him as they crossed the square where, in happier days, the Lautner Super Regional High School Band had performed in the bandstand. Those afternoons had been so damned good, with kids and dogs running around underfoot and women from the churches selling brownies in the shady park, world without end, amen. They approached a sullen, miserable little crowd. Nobody wanted this to happen, Martin could see that. They were looking away from him.
Bobby, you gotta shoot me. Don't try this hanging thing. Nobody knows what they're doing.
Martin, I can't. A car door slammed, and Rosie got out. She strode over to them.
Come on, Bobby. We're going home right now.
Rosie, this is law here, Bobby said.
It's murder.
I have a wanted notice. It's official. This is law.
Then something's wrong, because Martin's probably the one person in the world who can help him get this thing straightened out. So why do they want him dead? It doesn't make sense.
She turned to the others.
Go on home now. Go on, all of you.
Malcolm Freer and his wife and two boys went over to their old station wagon and got in. They drove off without a word.
See, at least somebody around here has some sense.
Then, in a lower voice,
Bobby, this is wrong. This is just dead wrong.
His hand dropped away from Martin's shoulder. Bill West stood waiting, wearing his butcher's apron, with a big coil of rope in his hands. Nobody spoke. Martin realized what Bobby had done. He knew that he had a few seconds, but only a few. He had also understood something back in that cell. He was indeed unique in the world. Something he knew, or could potentially do, was so dangerous to the enemy that they wanted him dead. That's why this little corner of Kansas had been scraped the way it had, and why the leaflet had been dropped. He was not a runner. He'd never even been in the army, or run a marathon, or, well, he didn't even jog. Bill and Mary West both jogged. He saw them all the time. Will Sampson was a black belt. Nevertheless, Martin took his chance. He turned and ran wildly toward the far side of the square. A shot, shockingly loud, winged off into the trees. Rosie's voice rang out,
"Bobby, don't you dare!"
Bobby was too good with a pistol to have missed at this range, and Martin reached the corner of the bank still intact. Behind him, though, he heard engines start up and feet slam on pavement. They all had guns, too, and most of them were skilled hunters. He sprinted across to Harper's Cafe, where he'd eaten 1,000 hamburgers, then went out the back and into the alley. He was completely at a loss. Then he saw a pickup sitting next to the wall, its bed full of sodden boxes of what he thought had once been vegetables, and he realized that there must be dozens of abandoned vehicles around town. He went up to the truck, but there were no keys. He heard an engine snarl nearby. A car was turning into the alley. He jumped into the cab of the truck and crouched down. The car came slipping quietly along. In it were Bill West and his son Coleman, both with deer rifles. How could Bill set a boy of 13 to hunting a man?
But they were so scared now, they weren't themselves, none of them. That's why they were willing to engage in this insanity. The savage was never far from the surface, not in anybody. And frankly, he needed a gun, too, and a damn car. The best place to find a car with keys left in it would be around one of the churches. People arriving late would have been in a panic and might well have left their keys and might well have ended up wandering. The nearest was First Christ, and that was where he would try to go. He didn't think he was capable of eluding them long enough to get farther away, over to St. Pete's, for example. He was just getting out of the truck when another vehicle appeared, nosing along even more quietly than the West's Lincoln. It was Mrs. Tarnauer's Prius. He thought that he might get her out of it. He even thought that he could snap the old woman's neck, but he stayed below the edge of the window as she passed. She wanted to kill him, too, did Jessie Tarnauer. She'd been a teacher, then a librarian. As soon as she'd gone, he crossed the alley and went into the back of the Darling Dixie Children's Store, long since driven out of business by big chains. Nobody bought lacy dresses for their girls anymore, and boys wore T-shirts six sizes too big, not little gabardine suits with fake handkerchiefs in the breast pockets. Carefully, he approached the display window. Across the street was the First Christ parking lot, which was indeed full of cars. There were a number parked askew, doors opened, as if the occupants had been very late and had jumped out and run in. He heard a sound then, the snarl of a really big engine. He listened. What could that be? Nobody would be chasing him on a tractor, surely. He trotted across the street and got into one of the badly parked cars, a Buick Lucerne that smelled of cigarettes and the floral perfume that Louise C. Wright wore. Her daughter Pam worked as a manager at the Target. Louise was a lush, professional grade. The car started normally, thank God. He drove out of the parking lot and headed north up Elko. He turned down the Makepeace's driveway and went through their backyard, then across the Morgan's east field, with the car slipping and sliding in the dusty furrows. He broke through a barbed wire fence and drove onto the same dirt road where he and Lindy had come to neck when they were kids. As he went down the road, he floored the gas, then hit the brakes to make a turn onto 215. Anybody who saw him would assume that he was heading toward the interstate. 215 ran straight for about 5 miles to a long bend, and he forced the car to give all it had. It accelerated to 90, then 100, then 106. As soon as he reached the bend and was out of sight of anybody behind him, he braked, then took Farm Road 2141, which headed toward the smokes and home. Yet again he made a turn, this time onto 6 Mile Road. He followed it up into the Western Division, where Louise lived. Her little place was familiar enough to him. She tutored French, of all the improbable sidelines, and Trevor had been among her pupils. Like his father, he was not good at languages. And suddenly, Martin was screaming and hammering the steering wheel and kicking like a lion in a net. He was stunned. He had no idea that this rage was in him. For a moment, it seemed as if it was happening to somebody else. But when the car began swerving across the highway, it didn't, and he had to fight to regain control. He caught his breath, choked back another roar, and thought, "There are deep things inside us that we aren't even aware of. Deep, deep things." He was extremely sad, but it was a dullness in the pit of his stomach, not the savagery that had come boiling up just now. He thought, "Not only can I kill, I want to kill." His people had turned against him so easily, just on the strength of a piece of paper dropped either by the enemy himself or by traitors in his employ. Unfortunately, he was fairly sure that the enemy was overreacting. He had no idea what he might do to defeat them. In fact, the modern world was about as prepared to deal with all this as the Aztecs and Incas had been prepared to deal with the Spaniards. It had taken the Aztecs weeks just to figure out that the horses and the men riding them were two different creatures, and they had not understood how guns worked at all. Of course, they had considered their adversaries gods. They had observed them working magic. The Aztec was overwhelmed by the gun, we by the light. We did not understand what we were seeing either, any more than the Aztecs had understood the actual way the horse and man worked together. The Aztec, also using a version of the Mayan calendar, had first encountered the Spaniards on the day that their reverenced god, Quetzalcoatl, had been prophesied to return. So they were even more certain that they were gods. They fit right into the Aztecs' cosmology. Somebody, working thousands of years in advance, had known when that would happen. But who? How? Did the answer lie a mile beneath the sea, off the coast of Cuba? And had the Brits been obstructing exploration to make sure it was not found? This, he thought, was true. Had to be. Coupled with the attempt to take him out, there was now no question in his mind but that the enemy had subverted world government, and had done so years ago. What had been that general's name? Samson. General Samson, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That man had been evil. But there was another, deeper truth, wasn't there? It was that the Spaniards were far more vulnerable than they had seemed. They hadn't defeated anybody. The Aztecs had been defeated not by the Spaniards' strength, but by their own ignorance. In fact, Spanish technology had not been that far in advance of Aztec technology, and in many ways behind that of the Incas, perhaps far behind. Perhaps we were still behind. He pulled into Louisa's driveway and was careful to park the car in its usual place. Then he got out and went around the house and back into the stand of trees behind it. He needed to get out of sight and stay out of sight. But this was Kansas, and these hills were low. Their woods were sparse, and they were full of meadows and grassy glades. If anybody realized he'd come this way, they would be likely at some point to spot him. He moved through the trees and up toward the ridgeline that would lead him, after about half a mile, to the old road where he used to bring his archaeology students to search for remains of the stagecoach that had crashed there in the 19th century. He'd also searched the area for fossils and arrowheads, which he'd found by the dozens, even some Folsom points 10,000 years old. He'd searched these hills with Trevor, teaching him the skills that he knew of finding things that normally would not be found. He clambered up the ridge, and from here had a long view across to town. He could pick out the white steeples of the churches, the roof of the bank, the roofs of houses, and the top of the Burnside building above the tree line. He knew this spot well. He'd been coming to it since he was a boy and out hiking alone, come and wondered here about time and chance and what life might bring. He thought, whoever is here is stripping away the people but leaving everything else intact. What the enemy was going to have was an empty but intact world and millions upon millions of slaves. Thus, he knew that the enemy might be more technologically advanced than we were, but he had a more primitive culture. No modern human society used slaves or even needed them. He wondered what manner of creature might come to this same spot in the future and contemplate those steeples. Then, incredibly, he heard a familiar but unexpected sound. Somewhere nearby, a helicopter was moving slowly from east to west, paralleling the ridgeline but out of sight, therefore below it in the draw where the Saunders River flowed. Who would have a helicopter? Certainly not Lautner County. Could it be the state police? That had been a state cop who'd showed up last night, completely oblivious to the danger, so maybe they were still functioning. The sound faded. He waited a moment more, then moved along the ridge. If Trevor had survived, Martin thought there was a good possibility that he would have gone home. No question. If he had been able to make it, he'd be there right now, waiting for the family to reassemble. The helicopter came roaring up, as if out of the ground, not 500 feet away. He dove off the ridge, down into the tumble of rocks that bordered the path. He hit heavily, felt pain clutch his left hip and leg. The thing thundered overhead. Sweat broke out all over him, and his muscles literally twisted against themselves, so strong was the urge to run. He told himself that fear, above all things, kills. Fear makes you a fool, and so he did not do what he so desperately wanted to do, which was to roll another few feet down and run, crouching along, to see if he might find one of the shallow caves that honeycombed the ridge. No, they would have motion sensors. In among these sun-warmed rocks, infrared spotting devices would not work. So he stayed still, and the helicopter went slowly off along the ridge. It was black, and the windows were black. He'd hardly dared look, but what he had seen was nothing but reflective glass. For 20 minutes he waited. Finally, he could bear it no longer. The chopper had been gone for a long time, and he was so eager to find Trevor that he almost couldn't bear it. His worry now was dogs. If they were indeed looking for him, they might have understood that he'd parked Louisa's car in her drive and come on foot. If so, dogs would follow soon. Warily, he got to his feet. His thigh ached, but he hadn't broken anything, thank God. He knew that he would not be able to stay at his house. He thought he might not even be able to approach it. But he had to know if Trevor was there. He could not leave the area without knowing that. As he trotted steadily on, his thirst increased fast, and his fatigue exploded into a crippling weight. He thought that his only chance was speed. There was too much power arrayed against him. The people of Harrow were more than enough to defeat him. But there was yet more strength here, and he thought that it wasn't the state police or the U.S. military, and he thought that they might have a lot more dangerous things than highly sophisticated helicopters. Then his house was there, his and Lindy's beautiful home, which they'd built when he got tenure. He was proud of it, the lovely new house, craftsman style, that blended so well with the older houses in the area. The windows were dark, but the house was not silent. No, there were vehicles there, 2 pickups. He didn't recognize them. So, people were waiting for him. Well, he could wait, too. He'd wait until the locals left. He'd wait until the military left. And they would leave. In time, they would all leave. As he moved closer to the house, he heard the sound of breaking glass. Then he saw a window shatter, and his reading chair come through and smash into one of Lindy's flower beds. They were looting, of course. Oh, God, please don't hurt Trevor if he's in there. He stared across at the storm cellar. Could Trevor have gone down there? It was certainly possible, but there was 50 feet of yard between here and there, and he didn't dare cross. He thought that the people in that house would shoot him on sight, no question. Then the helicopter came back. It hovered over the house. The people inside did not appear. It came lower, and when it did, he thought for a moment that it was not a helicopter at all, that it had another configuration entirely. It also made a strange sound, he noticed, hissing, like escaping gas, rather than chuffing like helicopters usually do. He watched the helicopter circle the house, then fly off fast in the direction of Harrow. They hadn't even landed. But surely they weren't in radio contact with the people in the house, not with townspeople. So what were they really doing? The destruction inside his house went on and on. At least he was fairly sure they wouldn't set it on fire. It was the dry season, and a fire would spread up and down the ridge. The volunteer fire department would be in a shambles, if it even still existed, so no, they wouldn't do that. He saw books coming out of Winnie's bedroom window, her old treasures, the Winter Noisy Book, and Cat in the Hat, and Jennifer and Josephine. He heard clanging as Trevor's Yamaha keyboard was smashed. The day wore on. The sun crossed the sky, and still Martin lingered, unable to leave the sacking of his house, in despair, in sorrow, and wondering, hoping, all the while that Trevor was hiding in the crawl space, or the attic, or the storm cellar. Finally, at 3:15, the two trucks departed. He waited. He scanned the sky methodically, all of it he could see. He was practiced at spotting tiny objects in sand, and the sky was not so different from a featureless wasteland in Tunisia or Libya. He was just starting toward the house when he heard from very far off a sort of sighing sound. Immediately, he faded back into the stand of trees. High in the afternoon sky, there was a black dot. They were still up there. He waited, listening to the faint sound of the thing, never moving from behind the tree where he hid. By the time the sound had gone, the sun was setting. He stepped out to the edge of the yard he'd mowed 1,000 times. Maybe they had left somebody hiding in the house. He hadn't really seen them, after all, just the trucks. He moved across the grass, aware of its whisper beneath his feet. Dear God, but an abandoned home is a lonely place. Martin searched the storm cellar. He pulled open the door and peered down inside. Then he climbed in. Things appeared unchanged. There was the lantern, there were the candles in their box, the 2 gallons of water, the box of power bars, all untouched. Martin was surprised at how much sadness weighed on him to know that his son had not been here. He crossed the yard to the front porch. The door stood open. He entered, careful to look first for wires across the entryway and not to move the door at all. He looked, amazed at what confronted him. "Trevor," he whispered, then shouted, "Trevor, it's Dad! Are you here? Trevor!" He bent down to the ruins of the dining room table. How could this be? Wood destroyed like this? He ran his hand over the lumpy, twisted mess. The wood had been melted. There was no other explanation. This hadn't been done by townspeople or any people. People couldn't do this. We couldn't melt wood. And look at the books, all turned to powder, and the knives in the knife rack, drooping like melted candles. "Trevor!" He opened the crawl space, looked inside. "Trevor?" No sign of his boy. He went upstairs and opened the hatch to the attic. "Trevor, are you up here? It's Dad." He pulled down the steps and went up. It was a complicated attic, and he was careful to look in every nook and cranny. A 12-year-old could make himself very small if he wanted to, and Trev was expert at hiding. When he understood for sure that he wasn't there, Martin felt himself just run out of steam. He sat down on the floor. He was suffering now more deeply than he would have thought a human being could suffer. This was what they called anguish, this searing, agonized sense of helplessness. Every time he thought of Lindy walking and walking like that, and his precious little Winnie toddling and limping, his insides twisted against themselves. And Trevor, the sense of him being somewhere in the wind, scared and alone, made him feel more helpless than he'd felt in the jail. He suppressed an urge to go up on the roof and scream his name, even though that might actually work. Trevor knew these woods well. He could be hiding back in there somewhere, close enough to hear. Martin headed downstairs, and as he passed their little office, he stopped. He stared in confusion. What was this? Increasingly confused and amazed, he went inside. His papers hadn't been taken. They'd been methodically shredded, and not simply ripped up, but turned into masses of what looked like thread. Books turned to dust were strange enough, but this was just bizarre. His laptop lay on his desk. He touched it and snatched his hand back when the edge of the screen collapsed under his fingers. He touched the keyboard, and the whole laptop simply disintegrated. He was left with more dust. He understood that he was seeing firsthand the work of the enemy. Whoever had been in those two pickups had not been human. He raced downstairs, threw open the gun closet, but Lindy had taken their only gun, her little shotgun. It was still at Third Street Methodist. He cursed bitterly, and as he did so, heard something. At first, it sounded like that strange chuckling he'd heard when he was among the followers, and it came from the woods behind the house. But then that sound was covered by another, the rumble of a huge engine, the same sound he'd heard briefly on the streets of the town. He ran into the hall and down to his and Lindy's bedroom where he could look out into the driveway. As he watched, three huge black Humvees came trundling up to the house, and black-clad soldiers jumped out, their faces covered by dark plastic. It looked like a ranger team right out of some military movie, but he knew that these were not rangers. He was face to face with his enemy. Chapter 10. December 11th. Innocent. Wiley came home to a very subdued household. "What gives?" he asked Kelsey as he carried his new laptop into the kitchen. She called out,
"Mommy, he's back."
Nick appeared, his eyes scared. "Why did you chop up your computer, Dad?" There were tears in his voice. "It had to die. Its life was over. Children, go upstairs." As they hurried off, Kelsey said,
"Daddy is insane."
Brooke lifted a box onto the kitchen table. In it were the remains of his old laptop.
"What's the big deal?" he asked.
"The big deal is, you went after this thing with a hatchet, and I want an explanation for that behavior because it's too far from the norm and I'm considering getting my children out of here. That is the big deal."
He tried to sound reasonable. He even smiled. "The hard disk was fried. Nothing would erase."
"So you went after it with a hatchet?"
"I did that to make sure the files could never be recovered. You can't put a computer loaded with files you can't erase in the landfill. Next thing you know, your life is going to be on the internet."
"So, my love, I have acted rationally, and I do not think I've given you reason to take my kids away from me."
She shook her head.
"Oh, Wiley, it's so hard. It is so hard, honey, and I'm getting tired in my soul."
"Now, hey, this is us, me and my girl."
"God damn it, go upstairs and set up your computer."
He went to her instead and took her in his arms. She felt pliant and indifferent, but did not try to pull away.
"Please, Brooke, bear me. You're all I have. Bear me."
She shuddered all over, then buried her face in his shoulder and sobbed bitterly.
"Don't start yelling," he whispered. "Remember the kids. Remember the kids."
And slowly, there in his arms, she composed herself. She drew back from him. They met each other's eyes. They kissed. From halfway up the back stairs came Kelsey's excited whisper,
"We have a kiss."
So the troubled ship of the Dale family sailed on, tossed on a dark ocean, lost to navigation, but still afloat. He'd bought a top-of-the-line laptop, fast processor, huge memory, massive hard disk, every bell and whistle known to man.
It's nice, Brooks said as he put it on his desk and plugged it in.
It was actually somewhat inexpensive-ish, but it has room to grow.
She sat down at the desk as he crawled around, hooking it up to their home network. He had an Ethernet. Out here, wireless was unstable because of all the electrical storms.
What's this?
What? He came up from behind the desk.
2012, she said.
Died under the hatchet, I'm afraid.
She stood up, gestured. He looked at the screen and saw words there, neatly typed. 2012, The War for Souls. It was his title page.
He reached out, ran his fingers down the screen.
But you... Oh, Wiley, this is weird. This is scaring me.
It's scaring you. I went at that hard disk with a hatchet, and this computer has never been near this house before. It's brand new. Look at it. I just took it out of the box.
Now listen, because I am going to believe you. I am about to believe you, and if you are lying, and you did this to impress me, or make me crazy, or for whatever convoluted, wily reason, then we are over. No matter how much we love each other, because I can't. I don't like things that are weird like this, Wiley. I do not handle this stuff well, as you know.
Brooke, on my honor, on my soul, on all that I hold sacred, I brought this machine in here clean and clear and empty. I made no effort whatsoever to put those words on it, and I really and literally cannot imagine how they got there.
She nodded. Then she kissed his cheek. Wiley, I choose to believe you. Because I saw you hack that computer up and the hard disk is still in it, and you are telling me, assuring me, that you didn't first put 2012 on an external drive.
Absolutely not. What external drive? I don't even own one.
I know that. So I think we have to now escalate this whole thing. This is genuinely strange. It isn't just wily weirdness, and my instinct is this. It is to protect my kids. Very. Very carefully.
I can't argue with that, she sighed.
I want to show you something that I wasn't planning to let you see, but I think you need to see it, and I'm sorry I hid it from you.
She passed him the second section of the Lautner County Recorder, and there, on the first local news page, was a fantastic and disturbing story. A man who lived about 30 miles south of there had disappeared while riding a four-wheeler near Coombs Lake. Local residents who wished to remain anonymous claimed that he was seen ascending in a shaft of extremely bright light. A search thus far has turned up no sign of William Nunnally. Dogs have been unable to gain a scent except from the abandoned vehicle itself. He read it. Read it a second time. Then he grabbed his phone.
I gotta make a call.
Matt was off his cell, so he called him on the official line.
Police emergency. It's me.
Not on this damn line.
Then turn on your cell, damn it.
I don't want to turn on my cell. You'll call me and bother me with trivia while I'm trying to work.
This isn't trivia.
I'm out there getting that drunken shit Joe Wright to stop going after his sainted wife with the cheese grater of all the damn things, and you call. Happens every time. Or I'm trying to eat. Then, for certain, it's going to be you.
Speech over.
I'm hanging up. I have a police report. If this is about a skunk, possum, or coon, please call the FBI.
It's about a possible UFO attack down in Melrose County.
I'm hanging up.
Call down there and then call me back. Can you do that?
Course not. It's not police business.
A man has disappeared. That's police business.
The fact that this tragedy is of interest to you is what isn't police business. Now I've got to go, seriously. I've got a call out on Mr. Leonard's god-for-damn big fucking snake got away again.
Don't hang up, damn it. Do this.
Hello?
Shit.
He slammed on the phone. He has to go catch a snake. That thing. Who in the world would want a 15-foot python for a pet?
I thought about a python at one point. And then I had children.
The phone rang. Brooke picked up. She listened, handed it to Wiley.
Look, the truth is I got an assignment down there, and I'm leaving in a few minutes, and I guess you can tag.
You're kidding.
No, and I'm not waiting either. They want me to look over the dogs. The dogs are acting up, and I've run a fair number of them. So I'll pick you up in 15.
What about the snake?
Screw the snake. A man's life is at stake here. I'll pick you up in 15.
He hung up the phone. Brooke looked at him. And?
I'm going down there with Matt.
For a moment, she returned to the paper. Then she looked up.
You know that I love you very much, she said. Never forget that.
He reached out to her and took her hand.
I've thought lately, you know, it's been hard. I know I've been tough to live with.
You have yet another book that's making you crazy, and I'm a writer's wife. My skill is to keep you from going around the bend until it's finished and we've got our money. Then you can go around the bend until I miss my guy. Then you have to come back.
Do I come back?
She squeezed his hand.
You come back.
He looked up, looked at Brooke. Where are the kids?
The kids are in their rooms, cowering.
Oh, yeah.
She put her hand on his forehead.
You're not going anywhere. You're on fire.
Matt honked. I'll take a couple of aspirin. I'll be fine.
You've been up working almost continuously for days, and a couple of aspirin aren't going to do it.
Matt came in.
Hey, Wiley, I haven't got all day.
Brooke went between them. He's sick as a dog. He's not coming.
Jeez, must have come on all of a sudden.
He's exhausted. He won't sleep.
She took him under the arm. You're taking a pill and going to bed, and that's final.
Sorry, Wiley. Feel better.
He shook her off.
Wiley, you can't do this.
I have to. Have to.
You don't belong getting mixed up in this.
He gestured toward the computer.
I need to look into it. It could be related.
You leave it the fuck alone.
Silence. The faint sound of plaster falling from the ceiling, and a decision of stunning intensity.
I have to do this, he said quietly. Or it will be my soul.
She wept, shook away the tears, and nodded.
Goodbye,
she said in a whisper.
Brooke. She shook her head, stepped back, then suddenly turned to the sink and started in on the dishes.
As they rolled out, he heard them clanking and saw her in the window and thought to himself that something indeed was being lost between them. It was like a quicksand pit had appeared in the middle of the marriage. Everything you did to save yourself made you sink a little deeper. He rode in silence beside Matt, who also said nothing. They'd been friends a long time, and there are times when friends just don't talk. They drove through Harrow, then into the cropland to the south.
Storm's coming, Wiley said. Look at that mother.
The western sky was choked with great towers of clouds, and Wiley knew that if there was a storm in this universe, then in the other universe there would be one 10 times worse, and he felt for them. He worried about the wanderers out there in the rain and the wind. He wondered about Martin on his desperate quest, a brilliant archaeologist who sensed that he could save his dying world if only he could connect a few more dots, who now wanted only to reconnect with his son and somehow save them both. The worst of it was that he couldn't help them. He could know of their suffering, but could not lift a finger. He could not warn Al North about Samson. He could not help Martin find Trevor. He could not give a single wanderer back his soul.
So why in the name of all that was holy was this happening to him?
They drove in silence. Matt followed the GPS onto more and more isolated back roads.
Where is this place? Middle of nowhere. I've got them figured for trailer trash.
Trailer people.
Still trash in my business, buddy, till I've actually pulled the knives out of the gizzards. Then they're perps and vics.
Wiley heard the voice, but only vaguely. He wasn't interested in banter anymore. He was beyond banter.
The guy went up in a column of light? And the dogs can't catch a scent off anywhere except the seat of the 4x4.
Which means it did happen.
Which means the dogs need checking out, which is what I am doing.
They turned into a driveway.
Here we are, Matt said.
They pulled up in front of not a trailer, but an exquisite, ultra-modern house. An architectural gem. There were half a dozen police vehicles of various kinds parked in the yard, a couple with their light bars still flashing. Other than the clicking of their switches, the silence was profound.
Nice place, Wiley said. I'll say.
As they came to a stop, a woman appeared. She was as stark as her ultra-modern home, reminding Wiley of one of Andrew Wyeth's immeasurably sad paintings of the model Helga Testorf. Closer, Wiley saw that her face was a tear-stained shambles. A teenage boy appeared in the doorway behind her. He wore baggy jeans and a black T-shirt. She came up to Wiley. She stood silently so close to him that he could smell sweat and the sourness of her breath. She leaned into his chest and clutched him.
I'm sorry for you, Wiley said. I'm so sorry for you.
She looked into his eyes.
I know you.
Holy Christ, this was not what he needed.
I'm from Harrow. You've probably seen me around.
No. From your book. You said they were good. In your book, you said they were.
I said they were very strange.
They are not good. No, Mr. Dale, they are not good. He had all your books, you know. He was trying to come into contact. He went up the ridge to meet them. And this is what happened.
Mrs. Nunnally, we have to understand that we have very little idea about what's going on with the aliens, even if they are aliens. That's why my book doesn't give answers. It asks questions, because we do not understand.
She put her hands on his shoulders. Her eyes were like fire burning into his soul.
There was light, she whispered. Two nights ago, the whole house was surrounded by it.
Oh, Jesus. And this light, he asked. What did it do?
Lit up everything. Then suddenly it's gone, and there's this clap of thunder, but no clouds, see? When it went away, he says, it's them. And the next afternoon he went up the ridge and it came again, and he went up in it.
This wasn't the killing light, then. It was something else. But what?
And that's what the farmers saw?
She nodded.
You're in touch with the aliens. It says so on your website. I want you to call them.
Nick and his friend had created a Wiley Dale website. It was very slick, but he hadn't seen anything on it about him still being in touch with aliens. And there had been many books since the one about the close encounter. The boy came out.
Please, Mr. Dale, tell them to bring my dad back home.
He was perhaps 17, a gangling kid with anguish in his face. He looked like he was in physical pain, as Wiley felt sure he was. Wiley realized that he'd been a damned fool to come here.
Call them, the boy hissed. I don't think I can.
Don't say that.
At that moment, a state policeman appeared around the side of the house. He came up, his face grim.
Mrs. Nunnally?
No, no.
Ma'am?
Oh, God, God.
She twisted
as if at the end of a rope, and then turned and clutched her boy. They came out then, from a wetland 1,000 feet behind the house. Wiley watched the play of sunlight along the silver bars of the gurney and the blackness of the body bag in the sun. "Mrs. Nunnally, we need to get an identification." She heaved with grief, but made no sound, which made it more awful somehow, this silent, gagging, shuddering woe. A man in soaking jeans unzipped the bag, and Wiley then saw something so unexpected that he cried out. He saw the head of a man, but with black sockets where the eyes should be, and teeth grinning from a lipless mouth.
"Can you recognize him?" one of the troopers asked.
"Dad!" the boy shouted. "What happened to my dad?"
"It's rapid deterioration because of the wetland he was in."
"Don't be ridiculous," Mrs. Nunnally shrieked. "It's a mute, Mr. Dale, a mute. They mutilated my husband just like they do the cattle."
Wiley was well aware of the mysterious cattle mutilations that had been going on for 50 years. Cattle would be found by farmers and ranchers with their lips, eyes, tongues, and genitals removed, and their rectums cored out. Often they looked as if they'd been dropped from above, and huge lights were seen in the fields the night before they were found. Between 1970 and 2010, over 50,000 cases had been reported, all blown off by the government as coyote attacks, which was clearly a lie, and now here was this human being, killed in exactly the same way. A hideous thought came tickling into his mind. "I have a beautiful home in an isolated area. What if they were looking for me?" One of the state cops said, "Ma'am, you need to say if this is Mr. Nunnally." She nodded, nodded harder.
"I think so. I think so. Oh, God. God!"
She clutched at Wiley.
"Help me! Help me!"
It was horrible to be near her. He could smell her sour sweat. He feared that he would throw up on her. The boy, his face streaming with tears, said,
"What if they come back? What happens to us then, Mr. Dale?"
What indeed? He could not be silent, but he had no idea what to say or do. He remembered the creatures he had seen and the figure Al North had seen in his room, that delicate, hard face, and he knew what this was, what it must be. They were trying to cross the barrier into a universe that had not accepted them as real, and this was a side effect of their struggle. The boy leaped at him, and suddenly he was on the ground, being hammered by powerful fists. He tried to protect himself, but the kid got through his flailing, incompetent arms. Matt and one of the state cops pulled him off.
"My dad wanted to meet them. Well, he sure did. He sure did, you bastard. Liar, liar, bloody liar."
"Get him out of here," one of the cops said to Matt. "For God's sake, get that freak out of here."
"I thought it would help. He knows about this stuff."
"Come on, Matt, please,"
the state cop said. Then he confronted Wiley.
"There's no law against the kind of crap you dish out, mister, but I have to tell you, there has to be a special place in hell for scum like you, lying scum. This man died, we don't know how, but it wasn't little green men, goddamn you."
"No," Wiley said, and the quietness in his voice drew the attention of all of them. "I am not a liar, and the real shame is, maybe if I had understood this better or taken it all more seriously, this man would not have died." He went to the car, got in, and closed his door. For good measure, he locked it. Matt drove them away. Wiley looked back at the fabulous house in the middle of nowhere.
"I saw somebody,"
Matt said. At your house. You're kidding. Last night, buddy. I didn't see anybody. You were downstairs. But where were you?
On the ridge. I was going out to see if you were fucking with the cigars, and I just happened to see this guy come across your yard. Came right up to the house. Looked in the window at you. Then went around the back, and a few seconds later, your computer comes on.
When was this? Wiley asked.
About 8.
8? The whole family was up.
Nobody did a thing. He was quiet, man, and fast.
Was it an alien? Could you tell?
It was a person.
He turned onto the highway. The storm was closer now. He punched a couple of buttons on his police radio, and a mechanical voice began to deliver National Weather Service warnings. High winds in Hale Center. Roofs off houses in Holcomb. Tornadoes sighted in Midwood County. Fast-moving, dangerous storm. He increased speed.
You think we're going to take a hit, Wiley?
That's a big mother out there, you got that right. The storm towered, its base black and flashing with lightning.
Matt, I'm so scared it's beyond scared.
I hear you.
You say he was a person, like us kind of person?
He looked like a kid. Nick's age, 12, 13.
So, it was a townie. Or someone looking for Nick, some friend of his, maybe?
No. This kid, he steps back, he looks at the house, he peers in windows.
None of the town kids would do that. There were only maybe 100 12-year-olds in the whole community, and Wiley knew them all.
No kid from around here, then, he said.
Absolutely not. He looked, I don't know, Wiley, but the word is confused. Looking and looking at that house, like he was trying to figure something out and couldn't.
He couldn't have been trying to get in. The place is unlocked until late. He could have just walked in.
He went in, and went into your office, and came out. Then he went down toward the Saunders, so I followed him. I'm right behind him. I thought he was some kid from town, was my impression, but when he walks up to the river bank, he did not cross the stream.
He disappeared.
Disappeared? Swear to God.
Why didn't you come into the house? You guys were doing a screamer.
But he disappeared? I mean, in what sense? He took 3 or 4 steps into those little rapids, the shallow place where it's easy to cross, right in the middle of it. He just simply was gone. Gone, Wiley.
Dear heaven, it had been Trevor. He'd crossed the boundary between the worlds, and he probably didn't realize it. He'd been going home, but come here instead.
For a long time, Wiley had entertained the notion that the weircats people saw around here, the black panthers you saw back in the woods every once in a while, were from a parallel universe. They were animals that had evolved an ability to pass between the worlds as a defense mechanism. There'd been a book called The Hunt for the Skinwalker, written about a ranch in Utah where scientists had documented the movement of such animals, not between this Earth and Martin's world, but yet another parallel universe, one in which creatures from our ice age still roamed freely. Wiley's mind wanted to race, but he didn't know where it should go. Silence fell between them. Wiley's thoughts turned to the poor, mutilated guy. What was that about? Something they were doing in their effort to enter this world, no question. But what was it? They'd cut the guy up, therefore had taken parts of him. He shuddered. He had a feeling if he waited, he was going to find all this out, and it wasn't going to be good. Not at all. The storm, when it came, brought long, heavy gusts of wind, and the police radio began to burp trailer calls, as they were known. As everybody in Tornado Alley knows, trailers actually attract twisters, which was why the Kansans trailer park had been the only thing destroyed by that tornado back in September.
I know something's wrong, Matt said at last.
I just don't want it to be this. Oh, crap, Wiley, this weirdness that seems to follow you everywhere you go. I never told you this, but when we were kids, 11, 12 about, I was out on my bike late. I used to like to ride past Sue Wolf's house and hope I'd see her on the porch and we'd get to talking or I'd get up the courage to ring the bell or whatever, and I turned onto Winkler and there is this goddamn huge light over your house. Jesus. I thought the place was on fire. But then I felt the thing, Wiley. I felt it looking back at me. And, you know, it did not want me there. When was this? Summer of, 88, I guess. No, what time? Oh, late. Could have been after midnight, even. 'Cause I couldn't risk her actually seeing me, of course, not fat me, mooning after a cheerleader and all. They arrived at Wiley's place. As he got out of the car, he saw that Matt had tears on his face. He said nothing about them, only thanked him for the ride and watched him leave. Storm or no storm, he clambered down to the Saunders, moving among the heaving trees. The little stream flowed normally. Some rain along its path somewhere had sped it up a bit, but that was the only thing in the slightest out of the ordinary. "Hi, Dad."
"Nick."
"I saw you coming down here."
"Yeah, I..."
"The kid is from the other world." He was absolutely so stunned that he couldn't talk. "I've read your book, Dad, and I know it's real." Nick was a private sort of a kid. Smart, as his grades revealed, but not by nature very social. Wiley and he had a good relationship, though.
"You've been reading my book?"
"I read all your stuff."
"And this kid, you've seen him?"
"Come over here, Dad." Nick led him a short distance away. They were right before the little rapids. Thunder rolled and wind gusted. Leaves raced past, yellow and red. It was quite amazingly beautiful, Wiley thought, but also completely normal.
"Watch,"
Nick said. He picked up a river stone and sailed it out over the water, as if he was trying to skip it, but coming in too high. In its flight, the stone did a very strange thing. It sort of jumped, not a lot, but it jumped in the air. Nick tossed another one, and this time his aim must have been better, because the stone completely disappeared. Never hit the water. Was gone.
"My God, son, when did you discover this?"
"He did it this afternoon."
"He was here?"
"In your office, Dad." "Dad, he's all dirty and he looks really scared and I think he's Trevor. He started reading your book."
The world heaved, and it wasn't the storm. "Oh, my God," Wiley said. He turned and ran back to the house, Nick following.
"What's going on?" Brooke yelled as they burst in. "Don't you two know it's raining?"
"They can use it," Wiley shouted as he dashed upstairs. "They can use the book."
"Who? Nick, what's going on?"
Nick hesitated on the stairs.
"The closer we get to the 21st, the wider the gateways are opening, and there's one down in the Saunders, right at the rapids. It's between our world and Martin's, and they're using it. We think his son is. We think it's Trevor. He tried to come home last night and came through the gateway instead."
Wiley said, "If they can read the book, honey, think how it can help them. We can let them know that Samson's evil.
Dad,
we can help them find the wanderers. Maybe they can turn this thing around.
Dad, I think Trevor came here by accident. That's why he was so confused and afraid. He thought he was going home. He couldn't understand why all the furniture had changed, why there were strange people in the house, any of it. Then he stumbled on the book."
"But he'll be back, of course."
"We can't know that, Dad."
Wiley went into the office, sat before the laptop. "There's something larger at work here. Whatever created that gateway, whatever prevented me from destroying this incredibly precious book."
Dad, that would be me and Mom."
"Excuse me?"
Nick nodded.
She has a USB drive she keeps in her pocket. She saves it on that.
He paused for a moment.
Don't be mad at me, but I wrote the code that prevented you from erasing it.
You can program? I didn't know that.
It's a few lines of code.
We need to find Trevor. I need to write about him, tell him where his dad is, give them a plan of action.
It's better not to talk about this.
Brooke stood in the doorway. She had the drive in her hand. But you, we...
She put her finger to her lips. Don't talk about it, either of you. Just let it lie.
Kelsey came in. She came to her daddy, crawled into his lap. Silence fell among them. Wiley understood that all was not as it seemed. In fact, nothing was as it seemed. What's going on?
Wiley.
Kelsey stuck her face in his. She held him by the ears.
That's what we don't ever, never talk about, Daddy.
She shook her head.
Ever, never.
Then she gave him a wet kiss and ran off laughing down the hall. Nick and Brooke gazed steadily at him. He thought again of poor Nunnally and how very close to this house that attack had been. The reptilians had reached Nunnally, and they could come here, too. 5 years ago, they'd opened a gateway not far from this house. What would prevent them from following Trevor through the gateway on the river? We could be in trouble here, Wiley said.
You've got that right, Brooke said.
But I don't know what to write about. I don't know where to take it, Brooke said softly.
Trevor, just think about Trevor.
Wiley closed his eyes.
Let yourself happen, Nick said. Just let it flow.
He saw a face, white hair, gray eyes, all crag and grandeur. Christ, I don't need Hell North. Then it came, a flood that blanked his mind, that broke his thought and his will and took him over completely. Throwing back his head, as if he had been slugged hard, he started to type. He watched his fingers fly across the keys. He stared, finally, at the words that were pouring out of him.
Al, he whispered, it's you. It's gonna be you.
Outside, the thunder rumbled and sheets of hail came bouncing down, and the trees moaned. Inside, Wiley's helpless shouts at a man who could not hear him echoed through the house in the dark of the storm. Brooke got water for him and tended him, as she always did, while he worked. Nick went downstairs and saw to the guns.